All right, now let's go over to Sacramento and have a few words from our special media correspondent, Mr. Gary Chu. Gary, are you there?
I'm here. I'm here, Doug.
I know you've got some words about what's going on in the world at large, and I was hoping you'd share them with us.
Well, actually, the words are not completely mine, but, you know, like so many other people with what's been going on with the war in Iraq, I'm surfing the net and reading all kinds of stuff from everywhere and spending less time watching the cable news outlets.
Because I think that's very wise of you.
Yes, I want to be as fully informed as possible on this and getting as many opinions as I can. And I got an opinion the other day that actually a friend of mine from another part of the country sent this to me, and I clicked onto it, and it was the Times Online, the London Times.
Okay.
From March 28th, written by Simon Jenkins.
Okay.
And the website address, if anybody wants to check it out and go back to the archives on the London Times, it's just timesonline.co.uk. And you'll probably get on and can go to the archives and find it. Simon Jenkins, March 28th. And it's the title of the article is Baghdad Will Be Near Impossible to Conquer. That's his headline. And, of course, with the Battle of Baghdad at hand, I mean,
yes,
closer and closer, I just want to read just a little bit about what Jenkins says here in one of his paragraphs. This is, in Baghdad, the coalition forces will confront a city apparently determined on resistance. They should remember Napoleon in Moscow, Hitler in Stalingrad, the Americans in Mogadishu, and the Russians in Grozny. Hostile cities have ways of making life ghastly for aggressors. They are not countrysides. They seldom capitulate, least of all when their backs are to the wall. It took 2 years after the American withdrawal from Vietnam for Saigon to fall to the Viet Cong. Kabul was ceded to the warlords only when the Taliban drove out of town. In the desert, armies fight armies. In cities, armies fight cities. Now, every soldier knows that cities level the logistical playing field. And this is Jenkins going on here. Bombers are useless in house-to-house fighting. Helicopters become targets, not weapons. Every building is a fortress. Every adult a suspect. The rule book says it needs 10-on-1 to fight in cities. Districts are hell to win by day and more hell to hold by night. Remember Beirut? Jenkins says, ask the Israelis. This is just part of his editorial in the London Times of last March 28th.
Yeah, you sent me this, and I say it is an excellent piece. I'd recommend anyone out there to get a hold of it.
And I would like to say that the reason that it struck me so strongly is because I'm thinking about all of our troops that are coming in mainly from the south, some from the north. I think the northern front's getting a little stronger, too. But I'm thinking about how Baghdad is the size of London. It is a large city. It's a big town, man.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a while. And I keep thinking about our troops in there. And I hope it's all successful, but I think they're going to have to hold on for a long time to control that big city. And my thoughts are with them.
Well, Gary, thanks for sharing that with us. Can you give us that website again?
Yeah, that was the London Times, www.timesonline.co.uk. Doug, I'll keep looking and see if I can find some more stuff about what's going on the other side in terms of editorials around in other parts of the world.
Well, please do, and come back and share those with us.
Will do.
All righty. You know, I think that the media coverage of what's been going on has improved considerably in the past week. You've been reading The Bee. I think you've been finding a lot of very excellent articles reprinted from sources of the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Associated Press, Washington, The Bee Washington Bureau has turned in some pretty good stuff. In keeping with this article that Gary cites that, you know, off the web from the London Times, was a Bee article from Sebastian Rotella, Los Angeles Times, that it's known that Saddam is a great admirer of Joseph Stalin. I want to quote briefly from the article, saying that Saddam's most loyal, best-equipped troops are digging in to inflict the kind of carnage that stopped Hitler at the Volga River in 1943. The Iraqi regime has spent years preparing for this showdown. And he quotes Tariq Aziz. People say to me, you are not the Vietnamese. You have no jungles and swamps to hide in. But the deputy prime minister of Iraq said that in this interview that You know, I reply, let our cities be our swamps and our buildings be our jungles. I fear that's what's liable to happen. I'd like to quote also from the same article that Gary was reading from. The Iraqis were not stupid. They listened to Western strategists musing about how a desert battle would be a pushover. Things would get difficult only if Saddam played the cad and drew the Americans into Baghdad. Why should he do otherwise? Another reprint from the Los Angeles Times, which appeared in the Sacramento Bee. Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University, former NBC legal commentator, talking about Peter Arnett being sacked by NBC. Turley says he's not really a fan of Arnett, but noted that his interview on Iraqi TV was rather unremarkable and understated compared to analyses by others. Consider his specific statements. Arnett observed that the United States appeared to be rewriting the war plan and that Iraqi resistance had caused the initial failure of the original projections. This statement is virtually identical to views expressed in forums worldwide, including coalition press conferences in Qatar. Arnett stated that the American war plans misjudged the determination of the Iraqi forces. This has been said not only by various journalists and experts, but also by American and British commanders. Arnett observed that pictures of the civilian wounded in Baghdad were being used by those opposed to the war in an effort to change war policies. This is demonstrably true. It's an interesting piece. I recommend it. He winds up by saying in the end, NBC has handed a priceless propaganda victory to the Iraqi government, which will point to Arnett as an example of U.S. censorship. This will only make it more difficult for our military, which is trying to win not just the hamlets and miles in Iraq, but the hearts and minds of Iraqis. And I would highly recommend a viewpoint appearing in the Sacramento Bee April 2nd, yesterday, from Peter Schrag, who works for the Bee itself, which I want to quote from. I'd like to quote from it extensively. We only have enough time today. I may come back to this next week to try and maybe quote most of this opinion piece. Peter Schrag starts by pointing out that, of course, Congress will give President Bush the $75 billion he wants, probably as a down payment for the war in the Middle East, as it should, and it will no doubt give him another installment when he comes back for more, and still another if necessary. Our children and their children will pay it off. To put that $75 billion in perspective, think of it as roughly the equivalent of all the current state budget deficits put together. Later on, he points out that in January, Representative Charles Rangel, trying to remind his colleagues that only one member of Congress had a child among the enlisted men and women in the military, suggested that maybe we should restore the draft. He was roundly denounced, but it was a reminder of the great hypocrisies and disconnects of this war. The president talks vaguely about sacrifice, but asks for none. British and American soldiers die to protect Iraqi oil fields, but as to any serious attempts to raise fuel economy standards or increase fuel taxes to cut domestic consumption of gas, forget it. The administration protests the brutality and disregard by the Iraqis of the Geneva Convention protections for prisoners of war, but seems blissfully unaware of how odd that sounds after 2 years of stiffing the world on other treaties and international understandings on everything from global warming to arms control. It's a good piece, paying for the Iraqi war and other small details, which Peter Schrag concludes in the end by saying the lies, like the war, become more lethal every day. Now, on next week's show, we're going to try and talk science. We've been talking far too much of politics and war. We're going to definitely talk a little bit about science, perhaps a bit about James Watson, who is being interviewed in the current Scientific American to hit the stands. I have a piece on Watson that from a few months ago I wanted to talk about. But we're just going to wind up making today's show, you know, all political. I don't see how we can avoid it. We need to talk at some length, which we don't have time for today, about more about these chicken hawks, these political advisors that have gotten us into this, what I think is an unnecessary war in Iraq. I know I'm not alone in thinking that. But just in brief, I wanted to cite the fact that is now becoming well known that these neoconservatives that are behind this are now lending their support to opposition groups of Iranian exiles. They may want to bring the Shah back to Iran. In Iraq, they're planning to bring back the king. In the wake of World War I, British intelligence put the Hashemites from Saudi Arabia in charge of the kingdoms of Jordan and Iraq. Well, Iraq got rid of its king a long time ago, and in this effort to bring democracy back to the country, there is serious talk about taking the crown prince of Jordan, who is a Hashemite relative, and putting him back on the throne of Iraq. Now, how you can have a democracy with a king, I'm not sure. We're going to look into that, though. And now, via telephone from the White House, spokesman Yuri Fleischman. Mr. Fleischman?
Yes.
It now appears that the plans for war are being rethought, given things turning out to be much more difficult than anticipated.
I am not sure where you heard that, but this is definitely not our position.
That the war is surprisingly not turning out to be a cakewalk?
Let me say forcefully that no official, administration official, has ever used the phrase cakewalk.
Well, it was implied that one of the biggest problems would be how to handle the 50,000 troops that were sure to promptly surrender.
Well, troops have surrendered. Thousands, in fact.
3,000.
47 to go.
It appears a matter of record, actually, sir, that Kenneth Edelman, member of the Defense Policy Board, said the war would be a cakewalk.
Well, cakewalk might be defined many ways, but Mr. Edelman is not in the government.
But his board recommends the policies the U.S. government's currently following.
Yes, but he is not an administration official. He is unofficial. No official characterized this conflict as, quote, a cakewalk, unquote.
Well, Richard Perle, who heads the policy board, said as recently as March 21st that, quote, very few people are prepared to fight for Saddam, and even fewer were prepared to die for Saddam.
Mr. Perle, as you may know, no longer heads the policy board, but in principle, I think he was correct.
Even though it isn't turning out that way in practice.
It all depends on how you define very few and fewer. By the way, Mr. Perle has graciously agreed to continue on the board, just not as chairman.
So he doesn't get to wield the gavel.
Correct, and he doesn't get to sit at the head of the table.
NBC's Peter Arnett was fired for saying that the U.S. war plan has failed.
Correct.
Is this not a totally fair assessment?
I would agree with MSNBC's Eric Sorensen that Mr. Arnett's actions were arguably unpatriotic. They might even be arguably treasonous.
So you're calling making a negative assessment treason?
One could make that argument.
Are you?
Not necessarily. But the embedded news people must observe military supervision. This incident with Mr. Geraldo Rivera is a case in point. One simply cannot broadcast troop positions. That's our position.
But do you really think that Rivera drawing arrows in the dirt during a broadcast would allow the Iraqis to fix a bead on U.S. troop positions?
It might.
Wouldn't their incessant gunfire day and night be more of a giveaway?
We expect Mr. Rivera to not give any useful data in his broadcast.
Well, that's certainly something he's rarely accused of.
Good.
Military commanders, sir, admit to changing plans due to strong resistance and surprise at not being greeted as liberators. So was the plan just to drive in and accept the Iraqi surrender?
We have improved upon the master plan, which was and is a most superlative plan.
Well, what improvements do you see?
We anticipate a coup at any time as we seek to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people.
Well, wasn't that the old plan?
Exactly my point. We're only modifying it, putting more pressure on the ruling clique.
So was it a good idea to bomb the Basra meeting of the Ba'ath Party if you're counting on someone rising up to depose Saddam?
Well, maybe the successors aren't going to be from the Ba'ath Party. And besides, survivors should be tough, the kind of take-charge guys we want.
So bombing them is a kind of Darwinian test.
Survival of the fittest, if you will.
Well, why did the U.S. bomb the Iraqi Olympic Committee headquarters?
Well, as you know, Uday Hussein, Saddam's son, does head the Olympic Committee.
So did you have some intelligence suggesting he was maybe convening meetings for the 2004 Olympics?
We did suspect that Uday may have been working on the pentathlon competition. They fire pistols, you know, and many military officers are known to favor this competition. General George Patton was an example.
I see.
And when you hear of our forces blowing up Olympic headquarters, know that we have been precise in pinpointing targets. Our advanced technology minimizes loss of civilian life, and that's a good thing.
Except for the occasional bombing of a market.
We are not admitting to bombing any civilians.
Not one accident.
No, sir. We are not even admitting to one.
Well, bombing operations were taking place near that market where 58 died.
Well, look,
Maybe someone was smoking near the fireworks booth, or maybe one of Saddam's missiles went off course. There are lots of possibilities. Our technology permits surgical strikes. Surgical.
But the Saudis have complained that some overflying U.S. missiles have crashed in their country.
Well, those flights have been suspended.
But you're claiming pinpoint precision.
Well, let's look at the evidence. Look at how we've blown up Saddam's palaces. We put a smart bomb right in the jacuzzi, the billiard room, and bang, right in Saddam's private bowling alley. If that's not a precise process, I don't know what is.
Except sometimes missiles land in the wrong country completely.
Pinpoint precision doesn't mean every single missile we ever fire will be pinpoint. I mean, come on. We don't claim to be perfect here. You know, I really must go, Douglas, but let me say that we are very, very pleased at how well the war is going, and we look forward to continued improving of our superlative plan.
Well, Mr. Fleischman, please come again.
I certainly will think about it.
Well, we are about out of time. You've been listening to Radio Parallax here on KDVS 90.3 FM. We would like to thank our special guest today, Dr. Lynn Roller, professor of classics and art history, who gave us a very informative look back at ancient Mesopotamia. I would like to thank Gary Chu, our special media correspondent, and as always, White House spokesman Yuri Fleischman. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. We will see you next Thursday at 5 o'clock. And now stay tuned for Todd Urich's program to follow, Hometown Atrocities.